Hey, Keystoners. Welcome back to Keystone State of Mind. It's me, Steph, your tour guide to the dark side of Pennsylvania. Happy belated Halloween and happy Election Day. That's tomorrow as I record this here in the U.S., November 3rd. It's a big deal and I'm a little nervous. And that's all I'm really going to say about that. Also, unhappy end of daylight savings time. It is getting dark at 4:30 p.m. here in northern Pennsylvania since we changed the clocks back at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning. Every time daylight savings time comes around, or the end of daylight savings time, I think of this old American Indian proverb that says, quote, "Only the government would believe that you could cut a foot off the top of a blanket, sew it to the bottom, and have a longer blanket." Just a different way of looking at this weird practice we do here in the States. And fun fact, there are two states in the U.S. that do not practice daylight savings time. That is Arizona and Hawaii. Just thought you'd like to know. I found it interesting. I've heard from a few people that are enjoying their new KSOM license plates. So thank you to Aubrey from Pennsylvania, Suzanne from California, Cassandra from Colorado, and Ellie from Pennsylvania, who all purchased their new KSOM swag. If you would like a KSOM license plate, just go check out my Etsy store. And you just go to Etsy and search Keystone State of Mind or KSOM and they come right up. Also, I will put the link in the episode description. Now, I only had 50 of these to start, so there's a limited quantity. So go get them before they're gone. Also, send me pictures of you with your license plate. I would love to see it. Or go ahead and just post them on the KSOM Keystoners Facebook page. Show everybody how cool they are. A couple of awesome Keystoners gave KSOM a 5-star rating and positive review. So big thank you to Cupcake and to Yay, I'm thinking, or Yeah. These are handles, so I have to guess. But anyways, thank you so much. It's so important to an up-and-coming podcaster to have 5-star ratings and positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. It puts my show up in the rankings and lets other people see it and helps the show to grow. So thank you very much, guys. I made a new podcasting friend. Her name is Cindy, and her podcast is called Welcome to the Neighborhood. Stay tuned at the end of this episode for a promo for her show. I think you guys will like it. So that's all for announcements, but I do want to give a little content warning. This episode does deal with violence against women and a little bit of violence against children, very small amount of that. And hold on to your butts, because we're going serial killer, bitches. All right, so let's do this. But first, we have to get into a Keystone State of Mind. As always, I'll be enjoying an ice-cold can of Keystone Light while I tell you today's story. And why not? What the fuck else is there to do when it's dark at 4:30? On August 9th, 1992, 29-year-old nurse's aide Joan Burkhart was found dead in her Allentown, Pennsylvania apartment. She had been bludgeoned, stabbed, and sexually assaulted. Police would soon find out that this was not an isolated incident. This was just the beginning of a homicidal rampage by a teenage psychopath. Joan Burkhart was described as caring, loving, and just an all-around wonderful person. But she was also a fighter. When she was 10 years old, she had been sexually assaulted at knife point by a stranger while walking home from the community pool. Ever since then, she'd struggled with depression and low self-esteem, but she still managed to be an honor student at Palmerton High School. She wanted to help people and became a nurse's aide while aspiring to be a registered nurse. She loved music and she loved her family. At 29 years old, she was living on her own and working, but she was really struggling with her mental health. She had been hospitalized in the past and had recently been threatening suicide. So when her parents couldn't get a hold of her for a couple of days, they really thought the worst. And when they went to her home to check on her, they found out that it was actually worse than they could have imagined. When Joan's parents showed up to her house, they found it covered with police tape and swarming with investigators. A neighbor had called to complain that Joan's stereo had been blasting for 3 straight days. When police went to investigate, they found Joan dead in her home. Thankfully, Joan's parents did not have to find her in that state, and it was police that found her. Upon autopsy, it was found that Joan had been bludgeoned 37 times with a blunt object. She was stabbed and sexually assaulted. Police quickly realized that they had been to Joan's home recently. She had called to report that her home had been broken into. A screen was missing from one of her windows, and $50 was missing from inside her house. Also, some small things were changed, like a fan that she had left on was now turned off. I'm not sure how seriously those police took the break-in at the time. But for sure now they're realizing, okay, this has to be connected. 5 days ago, her home was burglarized and now she's dead. The investigation began right away and police recovered what evidence they could. But before long, the leads ran out and the case started to go cold. It would take 12 months, 2 more murders, and 2 attempted murders for Joan's killer to be found. Let's fast forward to almost a year later, June 9th, 1993. 15-year-old Charlotte Schmoyer is delivering her papers. She's a paper girl. She's got a wagon or a cart of some kind that she takes along with her on her paper route every morning. Charlotte was very reliable as a newspaper delivery person. So when an observant neighbor realized that their paper was late, they were immediately concerned. This person has never been named. I don't know who it is, but they called the police to say, I think something's wrong here. That's kind of jumping the gun for me. I would not, if my newspaper was late, I would not be calling the cops. I might call the newspaper office or maybe the girl's parents if I knew them. But I guess these people called the police. That's what I've seen reported. And that was awesome. I mean, a little premature in any normal circumstance, but in this case, it worked out because police did find Charlotte's abandoned newspaper cart. They also found her Walkman and her headphones. And we're going way back here. If we've got any young listeners who don't know what a Walkman is, it was like an early iPod. It was a cassette tape player that you could take on the road with you, with some AA batteries. But when they found her Walkman, the headphones were pulled out and in another location, you know, a few feet away. So it obviously looked like there was a struggle of some kind. Police quickly found Charlotte Schmoyer's body, along with blood and broken glass. She had been stabbed 22 times and her throat was slit. Charlotte Schmoyer had a wonderful future ahead of her. She had a loving family. She had perfect attendance. She was in the high school band and the swim team. And she was also very active in her church's youth group. Charlotte was very dedicated to her job as a newspaper delivery person, and her work ethic was evident even at such a young age. Charlotte's murder devastated the community of Allentown. We've talked about Allentown before. The skinhead murders, you guys remember that? What the fuck is with teenagers terrorizing Allentown in the 90s? What was going on around there? Get it together, Allentown. Just kidding. Love you guys from Allentown. Totally joking. Any new listeners who want to know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to the Allentown skinhead murders. Then you'll be up to speed. Well, anyways, this teenage monster did not wait long to strike again. 11 days after Charlotte's murder, on June 20th, 1993, this murderer broke into the home of a young mother and her two young daughters. These victims were never named, and very little about them or the attack has ever come out. Police theorized that the intended victim was the young mother. But when the assailant broke into the home and realized that this woman's boyfriend was staying over and sleeping in her bed, he decided to attack her 5-year-old daughter. This little girl was raped and strangled and left for dead in the same room where she slept with her baby sister. But this little 5-year-old girl survived. And that is all that has ever been publicly announced about this attack. And big props to whoever kept this family's identity under wraps. Because a lot of times the press will dig and dig until they find out for a story. But in this case, everyone really took into consideration this 5-year-old girl's best interest, and I appreciate that. So all of Allentown was horrified by these attacks, but there were a couple of people who hadn't heard about it yet because they'd been out of town. Denise Sam Callie and her husband John Callie had been out of town on a 5-day sailing vacation. When they got home from their vacation, they realized that somebody had broken into their house. There was a bottle of liquor left out and open that neither of them had been drinking anytime recently. When they saw that, they immediately checked the house for anything missing. And John's handguns had been stolen. Now, some of this information that I'm about to tell you guys, I got from an episode of Your Worst Nightmare on Investigation Discovery. And I do love ID shows, but they are so corny sometimes. And it's hard to tell, like, what is acting and what are the real facts of the story. So I'm going to try to differentiate from the stuff I saw on the show to the stuff I actually read in articles and in my actual research. Because a lot of the stuff that they said on the show, it makes sense, but I didn't see it anywhere else. So I don't want to be giving out false information. And I certainly don't want to just regurgitate that show and the ridiculous acting. So anyway, that episode of Your Worst Nightmare portrayed a situation where the Callies had recently had some renovations done on their home. So they immediately suspected the workers of the construction crew for this burglary while they were out of town. And they really didn't think too much about it. Okay, so these guys, they had been in the house, they'd seen what we have. They figured out a way to get in when we weren't home and came in and took our crap, whatever. So they weren't terribly concerned about it. John and Denise owned a limo business, and they occasionally had to go out of town for work. So a week later, when John had to go away on a business trip, neither of them were too concerned. They had heard the news about the attacks recently in the area, and Charlotte's death occurred just a couple of blocks from the Callie home. I can't be sure if the press was linking these two cases together in the media. I don't know if anybody really realized that there was a serial killer rapist on the loose at this point. And so Denise wasn't worried on June 28th, 1993, when she was home alone. Her husband was out of town. She was home working, taking care of things that had been neglected when they were on vacation. When she went to bed, she heard something that startled her. She got up from her bed and looked around, called out to see if her husband had come home unexpectedly. And that's when a man jumped out of her closet and attacked her. She was able to get the jump on him and run outside. But he caught up to her. And right in the front lawn of her house, he beat her, stabbed her, and raped her. Her screams did alert neighbors, and when a barking dog startled the attacker, he ran away. And Denise survived, but she was badly injured. Investigators and the Callies now realized that the break-in and Denise's attack was linked to the other attacks. Denise and her husband installed a security system in their home, and it was a good thing they did, because this fucking psycho came back. But put a pin in that. We're going to come back to that in a few minutes. So Denise was attacked on June 28th. Just over 2 weeks later, on July 14th, 1993, the killer struck again. This time he killed 47-year-old Jessica Jean Fortney. She was also bludgeoned and stabbed and sexually assaulted. I have not been able to find very much about Jessica Jean Fortney. All I know is that she was a 47-year-old mother and grandmother, and that she was murdered during this rampage. I used findagrave.com to get some of my information about the other victims, but there was nothing there about Jessica Jean Fortney. So sadly, I have nothing more to add on who she was as a person or what her life was like. Okay, let's go back to that pin I just talked about when the lunatic broke into Denise's house again. This was July 18th, so 4 days after the death of Jessica Jean Fortney. and about 3 weeks after Denise's attack. John and Denise are in bed when their security alarm starts going off. They're instantly terrified. And by this time, John has purchased more guns to replace the ones that were stolen from his house. He knew they needed protection. So, of course, they jump out of bed with weapons to go see what's going on. But thankfully, the security alarm scared the intruder off. Denise and John called the police. The police came and realized, yeah, this fucking guy literally tried to break in this house for a third time. He's a maniac. The police department decided to do something kind of unorthodox, at least to my knowledge. I've never heard of anything like this. But they put a policeman in the Callie home every night until they caught this fucking guy. I think that's so awesome. So, yeah, they posted a policeman to sit inside the Callie's house in the dark for 2 weeks. He sat on the couch and read a book with a flashlight and just waited. Because everybody knew this guy was gonna strike again. He was trying to get Denise, the one that got away. So the 2 weeks went by. And this cop, you know, this was his last night at the Callie home. Denise was terrified. You know, what are we gonna do when he's not sitting in our living room anymore? And the police department was kind of worried too, but at the same time, how long are they going to have this cop just sitting in the Callie's house every night? So on the last night of the stakeout, the officer upped the ante a little bit. He left a window open. And wouldn't you know it? This dumb punk-ass teenage criminal took the bait. He removed the screen and snuck through the window, only to find an Allentown police officer standing there with a gun. Oh, but this dumbass criminal wasn't finished. He had a gun also, and he fired on the cop. Of course, the cop returned fire, and both were injured. The police officer and the assailant. This heroic police officer was named Brian Lewis. Officer Lewis's injuries were minor, thankfully, and he was able to call for backup quickly. The assailant took off, but they knew that he was injured. He actually had to break through a different window to get out. So they weren't sure if he was actually shot or if it was the broken glass that injured him. But investigators knew that he was injured because there was lots of blood. So they got a hold of the local hospitals to say, hey, if anybody comes in there with a gunshot wound or injuries from broken glass, you need to let us know right away. And that's exactly what happened. He did go to the hospital, and that's where he was apprehended. This young man was finally taken off the streets. So who is this murderous piece of shit? His name is Harvey Miguel Robinson, and at the time, he was 18 years old. As you can probably guess, Harvey Miguel Robinson did not have the greatest upbringing. There's not a whole lot known about his mother, but his father was a complete fucking piece of shit. He was an alcoholic and very abusive to women. He was never abusive to young Harvey. His father's name was also Harvey. Harvey Rodriguez Robinson. And in 1963, he actually was convicted of voluntary manslaughter after he beat a woman to death. This woman was 27-year-old Marlene Perez, and she was the elder Harvey's mistress. See, he was married with 4 children, but he was a jazz musician, and apparently he got plenty of ass on the side. Poor Marlene must have gotten in his way, and he killed her. He beat her so severely that she was completely unrecognizable. And Harvey Sr. was sentenced to 6 to 12 years in prison for this. 6 to 12 years for beating a woman to death. If he had gotten the sentence that he deserved, Harvey Miguel Robinson, who turned out to be a serial killer, would have never even been born. Harvey Sr.'s first wife was smart enough to fucking bounce after this, and she did not wait for him to get out of prison. I don't know what her name was or what became of his other children. I also don't know how long Harvey Sr. actually spent in prison, but I can tell you it was less than 10 years because Harvey Miguel Robinson, Harvey Jr., was born December 6, 1974. When Harvey Sr. completed his ridiculously short sentence, he married a woman named Barbara Brown, and young Harvey was born. Harvey Sr. continued to be an abusive alcoholic, and young Harvey was very much affected by that. I know there's been a lot of young Harvey, old Harvey talk, but from here on out, we're talking about young Harvey. His criminal record started at age 9 when he was caught burglarizing a neighbor's house. 9 years old. What were you doing at age 9? If you're like me, you were probably watching cartoons and waiting for your afternoon snack from your mom. Probably not committing a felony, right? From a very early age, Harvey Miguel Robinson had a serious problem with authority. Nowadays, he might be diagnosed with some kind of a defiance disorder. He hated his teachers and police officers and anybody else that told him what to do. Outside of the abuse that he watched his mother suffer, I really have no idea what life was like for Harvey in his home. But who cares, bro? You're fucking 9. Go play with G.I. Joes or some shit. Fucking dig in the dirt. Do something besides break into neighbors' houses. Even with all Harvey's problems with authority and his penchant for committing crimes, he did manage to have a decent time in school. He won some awards for his essays that he wrote, and he played football, soccer, ran cross country, and wrestled, and did very well in sports. He was a big dude and strong at a young age. Also, at a young age, he started using drugs and selling drugs and burglarizing homes to buy drugs. Harvey Miguel Robinson had many arrests and even some incarcerations in his teen years for burglary and drug offenses. But no one could have foreseen the violence that he was about to unleash on Allentown. It was only after his arrest for the attack on Denise Sam Calley, that DNA tied him to the murders of Joan Burkhart, Charlotte Schmoyer, and Jessica Jean Fortney, as well as the attack on the unnamed 5-year-old girl. One quick side note. There is an unsolved attack that some believe Harvey Miguel Robinson is responsible for. In 1990, 13-year-old Leslie Gerhart was in her bedroom with a friend who was sleeping over. A teenage boy came through the window after removing the screen and beat her in the head with a brick. Leslie Gerhart did survive, and no one has ever been charged with that crime. But there are some people who believe that Harvey Miguel Robinson was responsible for this. This was potentially his first violent crime, and he would have been 15 years old when this happened. Robinson was found guilty on all of these crimes and sentenced to death. However, Robinson has won some appeals. And because he was 17 when some of these crimes were committed, his death sentence has been overturned, and he is now serving life without parole. And really, it doesn't make much difference because there's been a moratorium on the death penalty in Pennsylvania for a couple of decades now. Harvey Miguel Robinson now resides at the Phoenix State Correctional Institute in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. I'm not sure why it's called Phoenix, but that's what it's called. And I saw his most recent mugshot, and he looks like shit. He was a handsome young man, and now it looks like he has no teeth and he's half dead. I guess that's what happens when you spend life in prison for brutalizing, raping, and murdering young women. Deuces, sucka. Well, guys, thanks for hanging out for another episode of Keystone State of Mind. Go check out the KSOM license plates on Etsy. Go join the KSOM Keystoners Facebook group. Find me on Instagram, and I'm still waiting for somebody to teach me how to use Twitter. Don't forget to hang around till the end to hear the promo for Welcome to the Neighborhood. And whatever you do, stay keystoned, my friends.
This is Cindy Martinez, the host of Welcome to the Neighborhood podcast. Ever since I was young, I've had a passion for true crime and the paranormal. This podcast focuses on cases and stories from different cities while making the Chicagoland my hometown or base. If you find yourself intrigued by crime and all things spooky, find us on Apple, Spotify, and Google. We post new episodes every Friday. Be sure to stop by.